Blog Talk Radio.
Life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes, so write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out loud. Own who you are, stand up proud. You gotta find what works for you. Find a balance that lets you be you.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. It is Wednesday night in the heart of the Bluegrass State, Lexington, Kentucky, where I am broadcasting live. This is Steven Zimmer, and joining me tonight in the co-host chair, or parts unknown, but not far from where I'm sitting, the lovely, the vivacious Holly Phillippe. Hi, Holly.
Hello, hello. I had a tooth pulled a while ago, so forgive me if I sound a little funny.
You sound good, Holly. And we're turning the day around. That wasn't fun, but tonight is going to be fun and informative. We got a great guest, a lot of knowledge on the business side of the indie book world. Great writer, successful, very successful writer joining us tonight. So that's a little teaser. And first one in the chat room is Metal Beck Harrison. Be sure to check out her brand new blog, Book Beck Adventures, where she's got her first two reviews up, some very good books. By Aaron Drown and Carol Preflatish. Check that out, and definitely hope everyone's listening tonight and ready for a good one. Let's see, Amy McCorkle, chat room. Holly is there, so yeah, if you'd like to chat with Holly as well, be sure to log in. Refresh. If you have any trouble, refresh. The rule of thumb, if you have trouble logging in to the chat room, refresh. That's best I can tell you. It gets quirky.
Yeah, because I did have some trouble, but it took me the third time I refreshed. I finally got in.
It's a charm, that third time, as they say. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, man.
There's Miss Sandy.
Good. Yep, there's Sandy Lender. Sandy Lender. And, oh, my God, we have Kenzie Michaels joining us. Oh, this is awesome.
I haven't
seen Kenzie in a while joining us in the chat room. Getting exciting really, really quick in there in the chat room. Yeah, it's been an eventful day, and we briefly mentioned that Holly had a not-so-fun trip to the dentist, and we're having not-so-fun construction going on in our court where we live, and oh, yeah. But on the good front, however, we do have some great news. We did announce the first 7 panelists to Imaginarium 2023. That's right, the 10th anniversary. And we unveiled the new guest banners and the first 7, and it's going to be a lot added. So be sure to go there and check out the bios of everybody. And we led the way with Tommy B. Smith. We also announced Marion Allen, Sarah Marion, John Bukowski, Lynn Slaughter, Babette DeJong. And I hope I pronounced that correctly. I definitely need to check on that. And it's last name spelled J-O-N-G-H. So, yeah, it's one that I have to guess as good as I can on. And then Aaron Crittenden. And it's definitely a great group, good example of the kind of range that we have. And it's going to build quick. I mean, we've got a lot of spotlighted guests. We do have our first Imaginator confirmed. We're going to be announcing that in the next day or so. Many more spotlighted guests, many more panelists. That list is going to grow quick. But we figured we'd start it off with a little bit of fun and have 7 announced today. And there's your 7 with Tommy B. Smith at the top of the list there. I'm looking at the page right now. And, check it out. That's a good bunch. Very excited about it. Yeah, I hope Tommy is celebrating somewhere out there. And definitely hope Branson is listening tonight. I know that Holly, that he and I are both eagerly awaiting Friday with the new Nothing More album release. The album is called Spirits, and so we're a day away from album drop day. That's a great metal band. So Yeah, we're having fun with that too. So, hey, there's some stuff to celebrate, Holly.
Definitely, definitely. And
but yeah,
Amy McCorkle just announced that she now has an attorney, an entertainment attorney. She added to the team. So, way to go, Amy.
That's
she is
awesome.
Up and coming, people. Keep your eye on that, Amy. She is she's on the way up.
Yeah, she is awesome. And definitely I mean, just building just an immense team and making waves, making progress, and definitely a definite model of persistence. So yeah, keep an eye on Amy there, and lots of good stuff coming. This is going to be fun as the next few months unfold. Yeah, definitely a lot to announce and celebrate. But yeah, that's the main thing for today that we wanted to make sure we got out to everybody is that, yeah, the first seven panelists were announced, and that begins an avalanche of announcements that are going to be coming regarding our guests because we have quite a few confirmed. So, and we are kicked
off.
And
a lot of new faces. Lots of new faces.
A lot of new faces, yeah. Yeah, looking at, I'm just trying to think on the fly here. Of course, Tommy and Mary and Sarah, you know, we've had them. But John Bukowski, I know John is coming for the first time. I know Babette DeJong is coming for the first time.
Yep.
And then Aaron Crittenden has attended as an attendee, but now is attending as an author, poet, and blogger. So this will be Aaron's first time as a panelist, which is awesome. And of course, Lynn Slaughter, she is awesome, and she's part of that great group, the Derby Rotten Scoundrels. I love that term. that chapter of the Sisters in Crime in Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah, Lynn's affiliated with a member of that with them, and so yeah, that's always a lot of fun. So. Yeah, a good bunch, and so that's a. I don't know if you do. You have any announcements, Holly, before we get to the folks that brought us the show tonight?
No, other than keep an eye out, and remember, we are open for Imagine Award submissions, book submissions, and they have to be submitted by the author, the publisher. Or who am I forgetting? Editor.
The author, the publisher, or an agent like a PR agent or other representative.
Yes,
yeah, so
representative
somebody official,
of the book.
Manager.
And so
yeah,
we are open for that.
Folks.
We're open for film submissions through Film Freeway. Go to our website. www.enterTheImaginarium.com. That's where you can look up for Imagine Awards or the Film Awards and get your entries in.
Yes.
We also are still taking guest applications. They're still pouring in, trickling in. Please get them in early. If you would like to present a workshop, get it in to me as soon as possible.
Yep.
Because I want to try to do, you know, every year I want to try to do different ones and mix it up and make sure we hit a lot of different topics and current topics, you know, that are going to be pertaining to, you know, the current climate and everything of what's going on in writing, film, and games. But yeah, get those into me because I've already started programming, which is insane, but. We're going to our 10th year. We have an overwhelming response now. Get it into me early. If you've got a panel idea, please hit me up. I know I got to talk to the master of some really good panels, and that's James Sabata. I got to chat my buddy James's ears because he comes up with some good ones. People always love to jump on them. So I got to give him a chat. And yeah, so that's it. Get your and spread the word, people. Please spread the word. Word of mouth goes so far. To your friends, to your colleagues, say, hey, there's this great convention. You know, if you, If you'd like to be a guest, or they can participate by buying an ad. They can be a sponsor, a patron. They can, you know, enter their books, enter their films. Yes, involvement, word of mouth, it goes so far. You just wouldn't believe how far it really does go, but it's true. So please spread the word. We love the fresh faces. We love our usuals, too. our faithful attendees and our faithful panelist guests, because I always know who's going to want to be on what panel and who's good for what panel. And, you know, that's always nice, too. But, yes, we love new faces, bigger and bigger every year. We want to keep that growth rate up and keep that foot traffic up. You know, more in the door, better it is for the vendors, better it is for the convention. So we want them panels heavily attended like they have been. Last year we had great attendance in all panels and workshops and the film festival and everything. So that's what we want to see, people. And it does take a village. It truly does. And we want to keep bringing Imaginarium to you all for many, many, many more years to come. And you know, help the indie community too, as much as we can. So let's support each other and lift each other up. We're not competitors; we are collaborators.
Yes, and definitely we'll look to get a portion, not all, but a portion of the programming will be up on the site next few weeks, because we're going to get that on a little early this year, just so people can, you know, start rolling around some of the workshops and panels in their minds that are definitely going to be on the board. So keep an eye out for that. And I'll go ahead and get over to our two that brought you the show tonight, and that would be Sandy Lender, the Genre Blender, and Per Bostet. Of course, that Per Bostet features Sarah Marion and Marion Allen. Both got announced today, along with Healy Harris, who will be part of the very announcement coming very soon, of course. But definitely thank you to both for bringing us tonight's show. And we'll kick it off with a little some info from Sandy Lender. So check this out.
The latest release from author Sandy Lender is book 3 of the Fairy Holiday series titled I Know What Your Vampire Did Last Summer. It's a standalone story in the series, but it's got all the fun, humor, horror, and sweet paranormal romance you'd expect of a Lender Blender vampire satire. Come on down to the Naples Hideaway and Marina for a fun and romancy vacay, but watch out for the Grendwolves and the random femme fatale who thinks she's competing for your vampire's attention. Pick up I Know What Your Vampire Did Last Summer by Sandy Lender today.
Thank you, Sandy. You're awesome, and I really appreciate the support. And now we'll go over to Per Bostet. Per Bostet Publications is a small press based in the Louisville metro area, specializing in speculative fiction and other outside-the-box books. The 40 titles in print and ebook formats and a handful of audiobooks, Per Bostet offers a little bit of everything. Follow the investigations of Private Eye David Blaze and M.D. Ebney's An Untidy Affair, a historical mystery set during the 1985 police bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia, or join the psychic private investigator Alan Rodriguez in New Mexico in A Handful of Dirt by Janie Franz as he tries to clear an elderly man wrongfully accused of murder. You can find these titles and more at PerBostetPublications.com at Amazon, or you can find the press in person at regional events such as Prime Crime in Indianapolis this month. Per Bostet Publications, where timeless tales unfold. Thank you very, very much to everyone. Definitely love Per Bostet. And so without further ado, we're going to move over because we have our guest waiting, and we're going to bring our guest on in just a second. But first, we have to make one of our snazzy introductions. Tonight, we have a best-selling and award-winning mystery author, who has the internationally best-selling Josiah Reynolds Mysteries, now up to 18 titles. She is also the author of the Mona Moon Mysteries, the Last Chance Romance Series, and, as if that all wasn't enough, the epic fantasy Princess Mora Tales. And so welcoming back to the show, also an Imaginarium favorite, the one, the only, the amazing Abigail Keem. Hello, Abigail. Your microphone is
amazing.
On.
I love to be called amazing.
There you are. I hear you. You're breaking up just a little bit. But,
okay.
Holly?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me better?
That's better.
All right, that's better. Well, I'm thrilled to be here. So nice to talk to you and Stephen and Holly again. And thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Oh, yes.
Well,
yes, been a while.
We're
always
glad to have you.
Yeah, it's fun to talk with you. You're always your insights on writing and the book business and the crazy world we inhabit. It always is fun.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy.
Yes, and you are at 18 books now in Josiah Reynolds' mystery series. That is impressive. I love it. So,
yeah, I'm running out of ways to kill people. It's very difficult to come up a new way to dispatch someone. But so I watch a lot of crime shows and see how they do it. And but I like my cozy mysteries. And for those who don't know what a cozy mystery is, the murder takes place off stage. It's not described at all that much. And I like I try to make these mysteries a little light and humorous. I don't try to make them very dark. I leave that to other mystery writers. But my Mona Moon series, those are historical mysteries, and I write about the 30s, and I bring in a lot of serious topics such as racism that was happening during the 30s, women protesting to get better wages. Of course, we knew what was going on in Europe at that time, and I weave that into the storyline. And at the back of the book, I put an addendum because I put real people and real events into the mystery, and I explain who these people are. So I really enjoyed writing those.
Oh, yes. They are great, and a nice there's a difference between the two series too, which gives readers some variety. I mean, I've always loved your titles with the Josiah Reynolds series.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of people may not realize you are also an award-winning beekeeper, and so yeah, you kicked it off with Death by a Honeybee that started the whole thing, and the titles that you have in this are great. I mean, well, of course, one of my favorites is Death by Bourbon. If you're going to have to that's the way to go. That's the way to go.
Death by Bourbon is one of my favorite mysteries, and it's also one of my few mysteries that's very violent. And it's very violent at the end. It just went with the story. You know,
right.
I got a lot of complaints about it, but the violence at the end went with the story. And I thought it was a great little mystery. So, to those who didn't like it,
and you had more than one title with a little Kentucky flair. You had Death by Derby, that's another one of yours,
yeah.
And then one that would probably get Holly, Death by Chocolate.
Yeah.
Or
by
Magic.
They all take place in the bluegrass.
Yeah.
You have to write what you know. And this is such a fabulous place anyway. Why would I want to write about someplace else? So it's got the glamour here. The money is here. The horses is here. And the history is here. The bluegrass area has tremendous history. So I love writing about this area.
Absolutely. Holly?
Oh, yeah.
We still got you?
It's one of the greatest states. One of the greatest states ever. When did you first started writing, did you start out writing cozy mysteries or
no.
Did it kind of morph into that?
I wrote the epic fantasy series first in the 90s, and I couldn't get anybody to buy it. So I've always liked mysteries, and I like puzzles. So I kept dreaming about this woman, Josiah Reynolds, a middle-aged woman who was similar to me. She was a beekeeper, and she just kept being in my dreams, and I felt she was calling to me, and so I started writing about her. I never really planned to write an 18-book mystery series, but this woman wouldn't leave me alone. And I don't take notes or anything like that. I write totally organic. I go wherever the characters lead me. And sometimes I don't even know who the murderer is until the last chapter. But I don't do outlines, anything like that. I just write totally organically.
You're a pantser.
I'm a pantser. That's right. I am. Stephen, what are you? Are you a pantser? Really cool.
I'm a hybrid. I'm about half plotter, half pantser. I've always said I need to have my basic framework, and then I leave room to breathe. That's the best way I can describe it, you know, because I've got to know my general course, and then beyond that, you know, have some room to develop if I come across stuff. So yeah,
well,
I'm about
when
half
you're
and half.
When you're a pantser and you're writing a mystery, you can really a writer can really box himself into a corner, which I've done a couple of times. But somehow it seems to work out. And I, you know, we check the clues and make sure the clues follow the ending to the book, and it seems to work out okay. So I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. But it makes me a slow writer. I think if I were more organized, I could write faster, but I only write about 2,000 words a day. I know other artists that can write 10,000 words a day. I don't know how they do it. It just that would just totally stress me out.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That would consume a whole day. But I do love how you brought up the character. You said almost the exact same thing that I've heard Anne Rice say many times over the years. She would say that Lestat just would not shut up because, you know, she quit the Vampire Chronicles years ago and said she wouldn't write another one. She left Lestat out into the world for him to roam. And, you know, maybe we'd come across things someday, and that's how she left it. Well, these last three books she wrote about Lestat, she said she had to write because not only were the people of the page, all of her fans, I was on that page, but, you know, all of her fans wanted her to write another Lestat book, but she had to because he wouldn't shut up. She said he kept bugging her. It was in her dreams. He would keep talking, and she said he just wouldn't shut up, so she wrote the last three books.
Well, yeah. I think a lot of writers are like that, and there's a lot to listening to your dreams when you're a creative writer. There's a lot to that. I really believe in it. I'm not a formula mystery writer. You know, there are formulas that you can go by. I don't pay any attention to those formulas, which my mysteries just roam. They just roam.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that makes a good book. And because it's so formulated, then you know what to expect. So, and one of the reasons I went indie and I did not want to get a contract at that time was that when you have a contract to write a mystery, especially if you have animals in it, they have in your contract, like on page 37, you have to introduce the cat. Well, I can't write like that.
Right.
You know, I gotta be loose. So being an indie author
it makes you more concerned with getting that cat in there and blows off your whole plot. I mean, it's not going to flow, you know, when you're constrained and having, because then you're going to sit and worry, well, how the hell am I going to tie this in?
I know. It would just drive me nuts. I couldn't do it. It would just make me a nervous wreck. Mm-hmm. So I like doing what I'm doing. And I put out about four books a year. It takes me about 3 months to do a book. I'm very happy with the results. Now, the Mona Moon books was only supposed to be three books, a trilogy. And then I was going to go on to another series. But it sold so well, I just kept writing them. And I really enjoy writing about the 30s. Now, most of these historical books are in the 20s, but nobody was doing anything in the 20s except drinking and writing in Paris. But in the 30s, the 30s, everything was happening. I mean, there was all this political unrest, the Great Depression, which is a worldwide depression, not just in the United States. And it was, and what was going on in Europe, within Germany, it was really a tense-ridden decade. And, oh, there were so many fabulous people in the 30s. This last, I have a book coming out, a Mona Moompa, coming out on November the 14th, the 10th book, Murder Under a Bridal Moon, and I have Aloha Wonderwell in it. Well, who is Aloha Wonderwell? Well, she was a huge explorer, and she was the first woman to ride or drive a car around the world. And she was big like Amelia Earhart. She was really big and well-known, and she gave lectures, and she did films. I would never know about somebody like that. And I was like, how come I didn't know about this woman? And well, so I like writing about these women.
Oh, that's cool. You add, you know, history in the fiction. So, yeah, well, you could, it's a little bit of the historical fiction then mixed in.
Yeah, I like weaving real people and events into the storyline. And then, like I said before, I have an addendum in the back, which gives more information about these people. But, oh, my gosh, I just love writing about these women. Just fascinating people.
Yeah, and that series, like I was about to mention, yeah, that series has really grown, too, with, you know, 10th title. Just coming up here, that's up to 10 now. So, congratulations! And wow, I mean, and it's getting some traction. Yeah, the first one in the series has about 300 reviews on Amazon. So
nice.
I think people are starting to take notice. Because obviously, you know, your other series have been out, Josiah Reynolds, for longer time. And if for folks that might be interested, her first book, Death by Honeybee, has 1,931 Amazon reviews. So
well
quite
done.
A few. But yeah, the Mona Moon mysteries are definitely gaining traction. And like Josiah Reynolds, both, I mean, you just, the cover scheme on both of them just is great. I mean, the covers show exactly
the
what kind of books they are.
I love the covers.
They fit so well together when you see them as a group. I mean, the covers just absolutely just fit. And,
well, you're very kind to say that. A lot of people think my Josiah Reynolds mysteries are for children because they're very brightly colored. And I went, no, these are cozies. Cozies are supposed to be very brightly colored, and they're supposed to have – you cannot sell a cozy mystery if you don't have a dog on that cover. That's the first rule. You have to have an animal. You have to have a dog or a cat on that cover, or food. It has to be an animal or food, or your books will not sell. Now I'll tell you another series that's taken off. It's called Camper Mysteries, and our own Kentucky Tanya Naps does those, and those do very well, and they always have a camper on the front. So there's a lot of these subgenres for these cozy mysteries, but mine are very brightly colored, and no, they're not for children, and the fact that they say death by in a Josiah Reynolds mystery should have been the clue that they're not for children.
Right. And there's the every just all the Josiah Reynolds books have a subtle honeycombs in the background, which is look for it, folks. Yeah, when you look at the covers, that's a nice
Josiah
touch.
Josiah is a retired art professor, and she is a beekeeper. I was a professional beekeeper for many, many years, and I sold honey down at the Lexington Farmers Market. That's how I made my living, and a lot of the characters that I have in my books are based on characters at the farmer's market. So,
nice. I know. Yeah, we've been to a few of those. Yeah, I know the atmosphere there. That's a great place for finding characters.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
awesome.
I will have to say this, the Lexington Farmer's Market is one of the best markets in the United States. It's really a wonderful farmer's market, and I don't think Lexingtonians appreciate it enough.
No, we don't. Well, there's a lot of things here we take for granted and don't appreciate like we should. Because we're so close. I mean, like me and Steve are so close to everything. We can't go nowhere right now, obviously, because we're stranded, car trouble. But when we're not stranded, yeah, there's so much we need to take advantage of and don't. I think that's with any local. And that's a shame, you know. We did go axe throwing a few weeks ago, though, with Noah, my son Noah, and his girlfriend. That was interesting. Yeah,
and how did you do?
Well, I'm gonna tell you, I did make a bullseye with one of the axes. I only did it once. It's hard to get them to stick in there. It's harder than what you think, but I did make a bullseye. And Steve was better than what he thought he was going to be. He's like, I'm not going to be able to do this. I've never thrown an axe. And I'm like, well, this got to be a first time for everything, you know. So, yeah, I think we did pretty decent.
Yeah.
I want to build some out back
right
now.
Mm-hmm. Is that how
we'll
you
get
got
Peter
out of
over
aggression?
Here. We're getting you and Peter, and you can throw some axes.
Yes, we'll have an axe throwing range, whatever it's called.
It's fun. It gets your aggression out. Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as like local produce, people need to take advantage of that. You really do, because a lot of the and I'm very excited that a lot of the younger chefs, executive chefs, are taking advantage of local produce now. They're doing, you know, making their menus around seasonal, what's in, you know, what's in season that they can buy at local farmers markets and everything. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's very much awesome. And, yeah, you know, the number one activity that we like to do in the Bluegrass for pleasure is eating out. That's
yeah,
the number one activity is eating out. We have more restaurants and churches
yes
than any other community I ever knew. And eating, we love to eat out.
Yeah,
and because there's so much competition, your food better be good, or you're going to go under in a couple months.
Yep, that's the truth. And we've got mm-hmm all kinds of great ethnic food here, and I mean phenomenal ethnic food and restaurants, and from all over the world. I mean, it's insane. You go do a Google search and see what all you know. Just Lexington has. Yeah,
oh, it's true.
It's great.
Oh, it's crazy.
So
yeah,
good.
I want to say
so
something about local. I want to say something about local honey.
Yeah.
People buy from a local beekeeper. It will be 100% honey. You should buy raw honey, not pasteurized honey. And don't buy honey in stores because it's been contaminated with sugar and with corn syrup. You want 100% honey. Now, they'll advertise it as honey in grocery stores, but it's not. So buy from your local beekeeper. So I want to say that. And I want to talk about something else.
Okay.
I've been noticing around young people that there seems to be a dumbing down of language skills. Now, I'm going to give you two examples that just happened in 1 week. I have a 16-year-old boy that cuts my grass. And I said something about, oh, I was casing the joint. And he goes, what's that? I said, you don't know what casing the joint means? And he goes, no. And I said, so I had to explain it to him. And then I was in a restaurant today, and I said, the waiter asked who was going to pay for the ticket. And I said, we're going to go Dutch. And he goes, what? What does that mean? Do you know?
Oh, wow.
You know what that means, don't you?
Yeah, you each pay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it means it's separate tickets.
Right, you pay for yourself, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to go Dutch. And I was like, this is a college student, and he didn't know. And it just seems to me that young people do not have expressive language. They don't use slang, or if they use slang, we certainly don't understand it. But it seems like the South is losing the ability to have colorful language, which I always put in my book. I try to make the language as colorful as possible. And I'm kind of wondering, are they not reading? What's going on?
Well,
what's going on with how we converse?
It's because of the attention spans. The attention spans have got shorter and shorter. Texting has ruined our language because it's short. And everything's abbreviated. LOL, you know, laughing out loud, LOL, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they even say LOL now. They'll be talking, you'll hear them say LOL. They won't even say laugh it, you know, literally maybe laugh out loud. No, they just say LOL. And it's shortening everything down because that's how they text. That's how they text. That's how they're going to talk. There's not a lot of phrases and, you know, slang phrases like that used anymore, which is unfortunate because those were really cool. And you know, they add, I was telling Steve the other day, they add every year to the Webster's Dictionary newer words that, you know, we have come up with. But the words they're adding get shorter. They are really not as many as there used to be per year. I think this year they only added like a handful. And I was like, wow, okay.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, they used to add quite a few because we come up with all kinds of different words for things.
Well,
but, yeah, I think it's the attention spans and texting. I think texting done it.
I want to comment on this because I have noticed that just in the last couple of decades, just about the last 20 years, a real decline in the breadth and depth of vocabulary. And I'll use this as an example. You pick up a Robert E. Howard fantasy. We're talking mainstream, commercial, pulp fantasy, you know, from the earlier part of the 20th century, right, mainstream. And you look at the average Conan the Barbarian tale, and you're going to see a much richer and broader vocabulary used in that than you're ever going to encounter in writing, a lot of writing today. And that's just an easy way of kind of showing the stark difference. Between not so long ago historically and today, but yeah, there's a real contraction of word usage, and I think it makes for a duller literary work, you know, because a lot of these, you know, words have nuance to them, and it gives you, and you have a broader palette when you use a wider vocabulary, and it makes for,
right,
I think, better writing by far, and using the same word over and over and over again. And I've seen that about the last 20 years. And you talk about Anne Rice. I mean, you know, she's, you know, got a lot of writers, you know, that are more veteran writers use a much broader palette than some of the
other ones. Yeah, and I mean, they'll even be occasionally now. You know, I read an Anne, but I have to go look a word up. I mean, she uses words that I've never even seen. And my God, look how many years I've read. You know, how many books I've read over the years. But, yeah, she still would throw things in there that I'm like, where did she get this, you know? And Stephen likes to throw those in there too. But, yeah, I think we need to do that. And that's why reading is so important. And not just reading brand-new stuff, but stuff that's been out a few years, you know, or go back and read one of the classics once in a while or a banned book, you know. If history bothers you, well, that's a good thing because that means you won't repeat it. And I've always loved that statement because it's like, yeah, go read a banned book and just see how things were back then. Like you were talking, Abigail, there's things that went on back then we just have no clue about today, you know, especially the youth. Like for the 30s, went on in the 20s, 30s, 40s. They need to go back and, you know, read a book from back then just to see the slang and the different language that was used, because people did have a broader vocabulary.
Well, what does that mean for writers? If young people do not have a rich vocabulary, what does that mean? Are they going to pick up our books? I don't think so. They're going to pick up books that have a simpler writing style to it. They're not going to pick up anything that is complex. And that bothers me. That concerns me as a citizen. And, how could nobody know what Dutch means? We're going Dutch. It just kind of blew me. And I sat back. I'm trying to figure out, was he teasing or what? And he says, really, I don't know what that means. And I said, well, it means we'll pay separately for our ticket. And and I was just thinking, wow, this is the second time this has happened in a week. And they're all young, and they apparently do not read James M. Kame or Dashiell Hammett or any of the writers I grew up with for mystery writing that used all these wonderful terms of gumshoe and terms like that. He was a gumshoe. Is that one of the reasons that possibly our book sales will go down? Because they're not interested in what we have to write. I hope that's not the case. And one thing I have noticed when you said rich, a lot of my reviews by professional reviewers, book bloggers, they say she uses rich language. I've noticed that in a lot of reviews. And I try to keep – I'm of the hard-boiled – school of writing. Less is more to me, and I keep my sentences kind of short and quick, and I try to keep the dialogue really pithy and fast. And I never really thought I wrote rich language, but apparently a lot of people think I do. So I always thought that was pretty interesting, but it just blows my mind.
Yeah, it seems, it should be, our language should be evolving and getting more rich and, bigger. And because we know all these, different things, and we've had civilization now. We've been civilized for hundreds of years now. So, it looks like we should be, up here instead of subpar. We're actually going in the opposite direction. But I still blame texting. I do. I blame texting on a lot of it.
I agree with you. I agree totally with you. Yes, yes.
Yeah, 100%. And it's a shame, because that's why I encourage, like, my grandkids my mothers of my grandchildren are in the chat room right now. And they knew what going Dutch was. I asked them. They knew what it was. And, they're in their, one's in their 20s, one's in their 30s. They knew what it was. So that's encouraging. But, I try to get the grandkids to read, trying to push that, especially to the older three. And she said during their, because Becca actually homeschools the oldest three, and she said that, maybe when they're on school break, she'd get them to read one of the old classics, because I want them to read, like, Tom Sawyer. Or, one of the old ones. And I think that's great for them. They need to read that and get some of that different language and ask questions. And that's how you learn, You got to step outside your boxes, step outside of your comfort zone. You can't just read the comics every day. You've got to read other things. You got to have a...
You do. One point, though, when it comes to young readers, though, I think it's important to also mix in things that are appealing to them, as well as some certain standard classics. Because let's face it, when I was in high school, we had to read The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. I'm not a huge fan of some of the Russian writers as I am of British writers.
I've never read it. Don't listen to.
And I appreciate it, and of course I read it, but it's a very long and somewhat dry piece of work, and I could see where it might like a reader that is not a reader like I was might really turn them off a little bit of reading something like that if they're forced to read it. So I think that it's important to work in, find good, compelling, like, speculative fiction or a good mystery or a good thriller, even a bestseller that might really excite them as well, and kind of mix it in with you know, Dostoevsky or, you know, something of, you know, something classical literature. I've got Fitzgerald or whoever.
A few things in.
Yeah.
Well, and that's when they really find out what they like to read, too. You know, you don't know until you start reading different things, and then you're like, oh, well, this is really fun. This is what I like, you know, more than other things. But and then you still got to read out of your comfort zone, too, you know. But, yeah, that's
I'd love to work with.
There's tons of different mysteries, and somebody that reads one mystery type might not like another. You know, they only like cozy mysteries, or they only like the thrillers, or, you know, there's all kinds of different readers.
Or find a way to break down some of the classical literature to modern-day situations to show, you know, how it is relevant and show how some of the issues that they're dealing with in a Charles Dickens novel, for instance, does apply to today.
Yeah.
You know, maybe technology's different. Maybe the setting is a little different. But no, I mean, the human, you know, struggle and human dreams are pretty much the same, you know, and that's something you can bring through if you discuss with, you know, young readers.
Well, if you think of Tale of Two Cities by Dickens, that is one of the scariest books. Madame LaFarge knitting in front of the guillotine and just watching people's heads get cut off. I mean,
absolutely.
That's pretty chilling. And that really resonates today with what's going on in some of these countries. So, even though it's a 200 or 100-whatever-year-old book, it could be happening today, what happened in that book.
Right.
Yeah, there's relevance.
Right.
Absolutely. And,
And
I think once, like, a young reader was able to see that, then all of a sudden the books, I think, come alive a little bit more. And they see, you know, like Oliver Twist and dealing with poverty, for instance. I mean, that's there's a lot of things that, you know, can connect. And they go, you know, that light goes on. And then all of a sudden they're reading, you know, classical literature with a different light. And it just becomes a different ballgame at that point, I think.
The Scarlet Letter was a one for me. I love The Scarlet Letter.
Hawthorne? Is that Hawthorne?
Yeah, yeah.
Nathaniel Hawthorne?
Nathaniel, yeah, yeah.
With Hester, with Hester. You know, when I read it, I didn't understand what the big deal was. I mean, you know, why are you making this lady wear this scarlet letter, scarlet A? And now that I look back at it, that book just makes me so mad.
Oh, it does. It infuriates. Yeah, it does.
Oh, the men are all screwing around, but this poor little Hester does something, and boy, they just really lay it on her.
And that's part of it, too, with a lot of countries nowadays, you know.
Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. I mean, I think that's a that's a thought-provoking novel in today's high-tech world. I mean, in our very with drugs and things like that so pervasive today. I mean, that's a book that I think can connect even more. I mean, to people today than the ones that read it back then. Even I think it's more relevant. You know, and I think kids should be exposed to these kind of things. And, and you could have some fun and work in a C.S. Lewis Narnia book or something that they might really enjoy and, make it a full experience. Mm-hmm. But, let's get those readers
Start
excited.
Them young. Get them interested young, because if they have a bad reading experience as a youth, then that kind of stays with them, you know. Start them young. That's why for Christmas I usually try to get all the grandkids at least one, you know, get them one book apiece. Of some sort of things that they like, you know, some kind of book pertaining to what they enjoy, because you got to get them started young. You do. And then that will help with vocabulary, you know, but, I mean, a lot of kids, they never pick up a book these days. The parents are so busy, you know, a lot of people don't read like they used to. They are coming back though. I will say, disease and, you know, some of the millennials, they're coming back to reading more, which is great.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was at a party recently, and we were asking what was the scariest book you've ever read. I would have to say for me, it was Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. That book just scared the bejeebies out of me.
I've seen the show, but I haven't read the book.
Me neither. I have not read the book.
Now, did you see the 1964 The Haunting with Julie Harris, black and white, or did you see the remake?
The remake.
Oh, the remake's terrible. It's horrible. You got
to
see the 1964 black and white, Julie Harris, and the director is Robert Wise, who made that movie and then went on to do Sound of Music. Talk about a classic.
Wow. That was a
wow.
I read that book and it just scared the crap out of me. So I had to see the movie. And the movie follows pretty close. Pretty close.
Really? The old one.
Yeah.
The old one.
Oh, the remake, I turned it off. It was just a joke. It was just a joke.
Wow. No, the worst book for me is It. It by Stephen King.
Oh, my God, that was scary, wasn't it?
Well, Holly loves clowns.
The hell out of me. I hate clowns. Absolutely hate clowns. And they terrify me. They're just the creepiest things. And so that book, I'm like, what? And then the movies, and I swore I wasn't going to ever watch them. My daughter's like, no, you got to watch it. You got to watch it. It's the greatest thing ever. So I did. And I regret my choices, but yeah.
Now, who do you think is the best Pennywise, Tim Curry, or this new guy Skarsgård?
Skarsgård.
You think he was the best Pennywise?
Yes.
Gee, that's tough.
Scariest.
I'm going to go with Tim Curry.
I love Tim Curry, but I am a big fan of the Skarsgård. All of them. I think their performances are just magnificent, and I love them. So, but yeah, Tim Curry is a hell of an actor. But as far as the scary meter, I have to go with Skarsgård.
Wasn't there a Skarsgård, the newest version of The Stand? Wasn't there?
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
Skarsgård
he played the main guy. Yes.
Which one? Which brother?
The evil one. What was his name? Shoot, I've read the
Randall
book.
Flagg. Randall Flagg is the
character. He played Randall Flagg. Yes.
Oh, that guy. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yes. He was like the Antichrist figure.
It was
Alexander. Yes, I remember.
Alexander Skarsgård.
Oh, man. He is so easy on the eyes. He's a nice
They're
looking.
Talented. Yeah, that family is pretty talented.
pretty.
They are amazing. Yeah, all the way back to Stellan Skarsgård.
Well, as you know me, I flip over all these subjects. I read a New York Times article about a Colleen Hoover. Have you ever heard of her?
Uh-uh.
Well, she sells millions of books. And what's so interesting about her, she does everything I tell people in Imaginarium on my panel not to do.
Okay.
She's indie. She does not have a publisher or an agent. She writes in different genres.
Mm-hmm.
She, like me, can never get a deal. She just started writing as something to do. And she's huge now. I had never heard of her, but I saw her book covers and everything, and she sells millions upon millions of books. And, she does everything I tell people not to do. She quit her job. She made $30. That was her first commission. She made $30, and she said it paid the water bill. And now she makes millions every year. So if you get a chance to read about Colleen Hoover, lightning does strike in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of us have to trudge along the pathway to stardom. It didn't strike in a bottle for us, or at least it didn't for me. I'm still trudging along. But I thought that was a very interesting article.
Yeah, she does romance and young adult fiction, and I guess they call it normcore thrillers. I'm going to have to look that up.
What is it?
She's a beast.
Yeah, she's number one on the New York Times list. And yeah, it's probably why I haven't encountered her books, because, you know, as a reader, looking at the books she writes here. But yeah, look, oh, man, yeah, she's done phenomenally well.
Oh, and she's only 42, so she's
20 million
a long road
books
ahead.
Sold and 1.1 million TikTok followers. So yeah, she's a big TikTok sensation too.
Yeah,
one million.
I may have to write her an email.
Yeah, new article on finance.yahoo.com came out. I think this is the one that Abigail's talking about. Came out one day ago, but it says that she has the worst case of imposter syndrome despite 20 million books sold and 1.1 million TikTok followers. But fantastic. That is great to see that kind of success.
Yes, love to see an indie, you know, do that.
She had six books that dominated the New York Times top 10 best-selling fiction paperbacks. 6 out of 10. That's not bad. Not bad at all.
That's amazing,
oh,
isn't it? It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Great.
I need to see you. We got to tell Yahoo about you. You need to be on there.
Yeah, I think so, too. And you as well. You as well. I tell you, this writing business is very interesting. And I keep thinking I need to do a new series, but I don't know what to write about. Nobody has entered my dreams for a new series, and no one is talking to me in my head. So I don't know what I'm going to be doing. Let's talk about your work, Stephen. What are you? I hear in the pipeline that you have 4 books you haven't released.
Well, I have one novella that has been edited that will be released before the end of the year. I have 4 novels I'm sitting and ready for editing that are done. And then I have probably about a fourth of a new novel written that I'm really making good progress on. So quite a bit.
Now, how many words are in one book?
Well, my epic fantasy novel is over 200K, so that's a monster.
Oh, my Lord.
But like yeah, right. my new Hellscape novel was around 85 or a little more than that and on the final count. Some of the others are just like the new YA book is a little over 100K. And so, yeah, I mean, they vary in size. But, when you put them all together, it's quite a lot.
I never write more than 40,000 words because I figure I have nothing to say after 40,000 words. I have nothing worth saying after 40,000 words. So I wrap it up around then. And I figure, by God, if they haven't caught the murder by then, then it's just going to lay there. So 40,000 words is my limit.
Well, it's like I always say, whatever the story calls for. My novellas are 25 or 30,000 words usually. I mean, so yeah, just whatever the story calls for. I mean, 30,000 or 200K whatever it takes.
Well, I noticed that my epic series, I usually wrote about 50,000 words because, you know, you have to use a lot of words to describe swords.
Yes.
Killing and blunt instruments of torture. That takes up a lot of room to describe all that.
Sometimes it makes for a good mood.
Up a lot of pages.
So, what are your new books about?
Oh well, I feel now I'm being interviewed by Abigail. This is a turn of events, a plot twist, folks. But I'll give you the quick answer. I had to get new titles out in all of my main series, so I have the brand new installment of the Faraway Saga, and that one is one, and that's waiting for editing. I have a new one in the Fires in Eden series, the fourth book, and that's a second one. The third one that's in the pipeline is the newest in the Rising Dawn Saga, and that is book five. That's book five, and then I have a new Hellscapes novel that's a standalone that's finished.
Which is a
previous three. three volumes were short story collections, but this is an actual novel-length story, standalone, that's set in that same universe, and that's the fourth one. And then the one I'm working on right now is the first book of a new Raiden Valkyrie duology. It's going to be a nice two-book arc as far as the story tale. And then the one that's finished and edited that can be released is a brand-new novella set in the same world as Raiden and Ragnar. But it's set in a culture that's kind of inspired by the Four Corners region of the United States, with the Hopi, Navajo, the ancestral Puebloans, those kind of cultures. But I've got a new character I'm introducing I love, and that's the first book in that collection. So yeah,
you've been a busy boy. You've been so busy.
Yeah. Holly knows every day I get up and I write every day. I always say just be consistent, and that's what happens.
Well, how many hours do you write?
Sometimes, if I have a really cramped day of business happening, I'll do about a 2.5 hour writing session, somewhere around there. If I am able to, I'll do about a 4, usually. Sometimes I'll stretch it just a little bit longer, but that's not the absolute norm. Lately, it's usually about anywhere from 2.5 to 4.
Yeah.
So somewhere in
that ballpark. That's a long time to write. That's a long time to write. I find most of my time is to marketing. I write less and market more, and
you're so
it's
good
very
at it.
Frustrating. Oh yeah, it's
so
very frustrating because I want to write.
Yeah,
right,
you're so good at it. you obviously write. You've got 18 books in one series, 10 in another. you're far from idle.
You're putting pictures on the board somewhere. How long do you write every day then? Miss Abigail?
2 at the most. After 2 hours, I'm just worn out.
Yeah.
But this marketing interferes, and sometimes I don't get to writing because I'm having to do marketing, and it frustrates me. It really frustrates me. Yes.
See, this is why I use a computer that is not plugged to the internet. It's a separate computer from my business computer. I really advise that if you ever get distracted, just to have a computer that's completely separate and offline. Use that for your writing, and I swear you'll eliminate all those problems. And you'll notice that when you sit at that computer after a few months, you'll have this Pavlovian response where all of a sudden your brain just goes, writing time. And it's weird how it kind of works, but it does.
Well, I think that's absolutely wonderful advice because I find myself looking at the news, looking at Facebook, and like who's contacting me on Instagram, I find myself drifting off. So, that takes up a lot of the time. So, yeah, I think
absolutely.
That's wonderful advice.
Yeah, the rabbit holes.
He goes in the cave. He don't even take his phone. He don't take his phone or nothing with him unless I'm, like, on the road somewhere or something. But, yeah, he don't take his phone or anything. And I don't bother him unless, like, the house is on fire or somebody's dying. I don't bother him,
But, no, it's so easy. And I talk to a lot of writers, and I'll be even talking to them online. They'll be like, they'll drop me a note, and I'll say, hey, say, what are you up to? Oh, I'm having a writing session right now. And I'm like, now? Like, as you were actually chatting with me? You better get back to writing. But it's true. A lot of writers, it's very easy to get off on a tangent if they want to check something out or get a message or get a notification. Somebody responded to one of your posts.
It pulls you out of your it pulls you out of that bubble you go into. Because you call it a zone, but when you're in that zone, you've blocked out everything else. You're listening to your characters. You've got, your subconscious is coming in there. You're right. And, anything that pulls you away from that pulls you out of that, It's the same like a reader, if you info dump, you put something in there, it throws a reader off. And then, the whole session's like.
Correct.
So, when you're concentrating on something, you need to just be concentrating on that. And,
Yeah, 2,000 words, Abigail. You said earlier you write 2,000 words, and that is a substantial word count per day. I mean, that exceeds the NaNoWriMo word count level. I think they're like, what, 1750, something around there, 1750 a day. I think it's the NaNo pace. But that's, yeah, that actually exceeds the NaNoWriMo daily word count goal. So, I mean, yeah, you are getting it done.
Abigail, do you do NaNo? Are you going to do it this year?
No, I never do that.
No, she's already doing
like,
it, Holly.
I don't like collective writing.
I mean, she's already doing it. I mean, the word count. I mean, she's already exceeding it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she's already doing it year-round.
I have a girlfriend that you know who's a writer, and she says, oh, I just wrote a book. And I said, well, how long did it take you? And she said, oh, it took me a week. And I went, a week? Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. I said it takes me 3 months to get a book together. So
that's
there
like
are
Carolyn
some people
Arnold.
That just have.
Yeah, I love Carolyn Arnold. She Carolyn Arnold was one of our guests at Imaginarium. She's from Canada.
Yep,
fabulous writer, bestseller. But, yeah, she routinely hits these 10,000 word counts on daily writing sessions.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my God. I was like, if I could do that, I mean, yeah, I'd get an epic fantasy novel done in 20 days, you know. I'm like, oh, man. It's like, how do you pull that off? That is awesome. 10,000 words, you know, like a day. And, I'm with you, Abigail. Like that. I have done days where I've gotten, you know, multi-thousand word counts and, you know, pulled off like an epic day, like a single event. But just these people that do it on a regular basis, that's pretty amazing. That is something else.
Yeah, it is. You're very fortunate, Stephen, that you have Holly to do all your marketing for you.
We work together. No, I do marketing, but not to your skill level at it, but yeah.
It's definitely a team effort, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with Imagineering consuming all my time now. That consumes most of my time, that and editing. So,
yeah.
I don't
Lots
get to market like I used to. And that's what a lot of these young writers, the poor things, they get into it and they think, oh, I'm going to sell a book. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to sell a bunch of copies.
Oh, my God.
They don't. Yeah. They come in naive and not realizing that writing the book was the easy part. Selling it is a whole other problem.
Well, the problem is they'll read the article about Colleen Hoover and they'll think that's the norm. They'll think that's
right.
You know, that's exactly what's going to happen, you know, and that's the problem, you know, because I think it came out in audit. What was it? An overwhelming majority of major press releases didn't even sell more than 15 copies, and it was they did an audit, and it was and look it up. I mean, Google it. They recently during a court case they did an audit of one or more of the major presses. And it was like overwhelming majority of the titles sold no more than like 15 copies, literally.
Jeez.
And only a few sold titanic amounts that were carrying those publishing houses. But, yeah, a large chunk sold almost nothing. I mean, you know, and that was like, wow, you know, for we're talking major press releases. So, it's not quite the same for everybody.
What's your best advice for new authors, Abigail?
I was just going to say, Holly, the advice I always give, keep your day job.
Yes. It only gets worse from here. That's what we tell everybody.
Yeah, keep your day job. And, you know, I don't try to help young writers anymore because when I tell them what they're doing wrong, they get mad.
Right.
Like, don't ask my opinion if you don't want to hear the truth.
Right.
And the truth usually has to do with their cover. The cover's not right. It has to do that they're writing standalones. And standalones do sell if you've got a big name, but for young writers, it's best to write a series. They don't want to hear that.
Right.
They don't want to hear write short because that's you know, you write short, you can put out more books. in your series.
Right.
They don't want to hear that. But mostly it has to do and that they have to get a professional editor. They always say, oh, I'm a good proofreader. Well, I know from my own experience, I'm a horrible proofreader. I would never proof my own work. I'm terrible at it. And it's just like, I have just shut that down to just keep your day job. That's all I say anymore. Keep your day job.
And
you go.
I tell them, realize, you know, you've got to breed your brand. I mean, you're a brand now. Your book's not going to sell itself. You've got to learn to be a business person. You've got to learn to be a marketer. You've got to learn strategy. You've got to keep up with the new strategies because, you know, they change like we change our
every
underwear.
Every 6 months.
Yep.
Yes,
what
yes. Every
best,
6 months is different.
It cycles, you know, and so, yeah. I mean, it's a lot to keep up with. And they just think, oh, I'm going to write it. No. There's a whole other side to that, and that's why it's good advice. Keep your day job, you know, and if you can make a living at it eventually, good for you. But, you know, your chances, you know, slim to none if you want and you're planning on being the next Anne Rice or the next Stephen King and being that successful. I mean, that's a 1 in a million shot, just like a, you know, a famous rock band or a famous movie star.
Well,
realize how many people scrape for that.
They do not understand that your book cover is more important than what you actually write.
Yep.
I can't stress that because they have to. Something has to attract them to pick the book up.
Yep.
And so it has to be as your cover, and they don't believe me on that. So, you know, I just like, okay, well, this is the way it is. Keep your day job and hope for the best.
Right. And your cover needs to definitely pertain to your story. You know, you can't just slap something on there that has nothing to do with your story or your characters. It needs to a little bit give a taste of the story without giving too much, you know. And it has to be a good cover. It has to be eye-catching, you know. And that changes, too, you know, every few months. Colors work for, you know, some colors work on this social media platform. Some work for this cover. Some work, you know, and it does change. And that's why a lot of times if you're sitting on a stale book that hasn't been selling quite so well or it's an older book, redo a cover. Put it out, you know, re-release it with a brand new
re-launch
cover.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, relaunch
it. Oh, yeah.
It.
Oh, yeah. I've done that,
you know,
several times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Got brand new covers and relaunched it.
Right. Something more modern, you know, and there you go. Bingo. And it starts selling again, you know. Yep.
Absolutely.
It's a lot.
So, listeners, for those who are listening to my voice, purchase a Josiah Reynolds mystery and a Mona Moon mystery, and I think you will enjoy them.
Yes. Absolutely. I think
and
so,
too. And they start anywhere in the series. You don't have to start from book one and read on. Correct? Or
no,
do you
they're
need
standalone.
Okay.
They're all standalone. There's a theme that runs through them, but they're standalones.
Right.
You don't have to start at the beginning.
Okay.
Right.
No.
Well, see, there you go, people.
Hey, Holly, I did look up that stat. It was Penguin Random House antitrust trial, and it revealed that out of 58,000 trade titles published annually, half of those titles sold fewer than one dozen books. And, of course, that, you know, that's not all new releases. It's counting backlist titles as well, which,
right,
you know, could have sold better in the past, obviously, than they do in the present.
Right.
But, it came out in that trial that out of 58,000 titles active in a year, half of them sold fewer than a dozen books.
Yeah,
just want to make sure I got that straight on the that bit of info. But yeah, it's pretty eye opening.
There's a lot of people. It makes me so upset when people say, "Oh, I don't want to read indie books because they had a bad experience or whatever. Well, pay attention to the bad reviews with the good reviews, because a lot of times people will be blaming Amazon or be griping about Amazon, which authors have no control over. If Amazon delivers you a damaged book or not on time, the author had nothing to do with that, for one thing. Another thing is, if they don't have a professional editor, another pair of eyes on that book, and they did all the editing themselves, red flag, because an author cannot properly edit their own book. They could turn in a clean copy and do all the editing they want. However, they're still going to miss things because your brain replaces lost words. It replaces, you know, like words spelt differently, like the word which, where, you know, here, stuff like that. Your brain will replace it with what you think is was right, and then you've read over it a million times, but you've seen it what you thought was the right way, and it's actually incorrect. You need that other pair of eyes. I mean, you have to. So there is a lot of bad books out there. But you know, listeners, don't let that deter you. There's a, oh, my God, the best authors, I think probably 90% of the best authors are indie authors, honestly.
Let me give a perspective here, though, too. We know, Holly, and we're not going to use names. We're not going to put anybody on the spot. But we know some people with major presses that had to basically get their books edited on their own because the press wasn't – they didn't even edit it. They didn't provide you know, somebody to really even do content editing. And this is on the big – you know, the big level, and they were they had to on their own get somebody an editor to just to make sure that, you know, they got it pulled together in a quality way, and so this kind of thing even happens on the major press level, you know, because they're, you know, they're definitely counting pennies often, and sometimes they don't even you know, thoroughly edit a book. So yeah, not just the indie level. Mm-mm. But yeah,
well,
Abigail.
What gets me, I do not like people writing negative reviews for very young writers. I don't like that at all because there are no Max Perkinses anymore. And if you don't know who Max Perkins was, he was the celebrated editor of Hemingway and Thomas Wolfe. These people would not have reached the status they did if Max Perkins hadn't taken his red pen and just crossed line after line. That's what he did with Thomas Wolfe, his books, and he helped shape Hemingway's books and F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. There aren't editors anymore that will take that time and interest in an individual writer anymore. Hemingway did not become Hemingway in a first book. He was a newspaper reporter, and it took a long time for him to learn his craft. And I don't like seeing negative because the worst thing you can do to a young writer is take away their confidence.
That's
and
true.
I don't like it. I don't like it. And
if
I think
if
it's
no more than 3 or 4 stars, then just don't say anything at all. You know?
Yeah. If you can't give a positive review on a young writer, then just don't say anything. Don't take away their confidence. They could develop into a wonderful writer. You have to start somewhere. And as you get more proficient, you become a better writer as time goes on. Do you think Anne Rice was Anne Rice at 20? Do you think she could write what she did at 20? No. It took a while for her to develop her style.
Right. That's exactly right. Your first book is not going to be your masterpiece. That's not your manifesto. You know, it's like with anything you do, the more you do it, the better you get. Period. It's the truth. Yep. And you
well,
do
like
get
my,
those one in a million things like, oh, what was the darker... What was the book, Steve, leaving my mind? The BDSM books that got really huge and popular.
50 Shades of Grey.
50 Shades of Grey.
Right. The writing was horrible. But for some reason, people, the soccer moms went crazy and you know, it's they sold millions and millions and millions of copies, you know. But that's a one in probably a trillion shot these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, that lady was born under a lucky star for sure. Definitely.
You got that. Yep.
Yeah, it was
yep.
not that was in bad need of an edit. I read the first
yep.
few pages and I was like, ooh. Yeah. But hey, it worked. So more power to her
yeah,
on that.
Her.
Definitely
yeah.
connected. But
right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got about about nine, a little bit over 9 minutes left before we wrap up, Abigail. So I do want to cover some of the stuff coming up for you. I want to revisit what you have on the release schedule, and then also if you have any events coming up.
Oh, gosh, I got to look at my calendar. Well, I have a book coming out on November the 14th. It's a Mon Ami mystery. It's Murder Under a Bridal Moon. All takes place in the 30s. It's 1934 now, and she's trying to get married to a duke, but all these people keep dropping by her manor, and she, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe drops by, Mabel Dodge drops by, Aloha Wonderhell drops by, Alice Roosevelt Longworth comes by, and I write about women for women, and I try to make them, I try to introduce 21st century women to these fabulous.
Uh-oh.
Did we lose her?
I think we lost Abigail. So hold on, folks. Hopefully she'll call right back here. She was writing a good promo for her new book.
I know.
Yeah, coming up in November.
About her series.
Yeah, all of a sudden it went, oh, and I was like, but hey, that's the excitement and the adventure of live calls. Hopefully, yeah, call back Abigail. Hopefully she's got a another connection there.
Well, you guys find her at AbigailKeem on Facebook and
yeah.
.com. You go to .com and find all her links to her books
here she
and
is.
All that.
Here she is. I'll get her on board
okay.
here. She just called back. Okay, Abigail, there you are.
Yes,
we lost
I'm
you
here.
For a
I'm
second.
Here. Oh, it must have been me. It must have been me. So I have that
well,
book
go
coming out on November the 14th, and I think that's all I have going this year. Next year I hope to be at a lot of conferences and a lot of book fairs. I haven't been anywhere since this pandemic. I've been kind of keeping low, but I hope to be out and meet and greet people and be with my author friends and just kicking up our heels.
Yes,
that's right.
Definitely. Well, we were honored enough that you did sneak in to do some good stuff for us at Imaginarium. So can't wait for you to be able to enjoy the full weekend on the 10th anniversary. So, yeah, definitely
yeah.
mark that in July.
After I did my panel, I flew out of there because I didn't want to get COVID. I mean, you could have stopped
right.
me with a – I was like, fly the
yeah,
bird out of there.
I was like, I didn't see Abigail at all. She was just gone. And everybody's like, no,
yep.
she was gone. They said she did her panel, her workshop. She was gone.
Yep. Well, you get to relax hopefully next July and – enjoy what we hope is the best Imaginarium yet. So that's something for 2023. But yeah, like you, I definitely look forward to doing more live for sure. Because it's been
well,
a kind of light couple of years.
Congratulations on Imaginarium. What I saw, it was a huge hit. You had so many people; it was hard to walk and. If you like fantasy writing and any of that type of fantasy or sci-fi, definitely you want to attend Imaginarium.
We have everybody. There's children's books, there's romance panels. There's I try to hit every single
poetry
that's out there. Every genre that we give an award out for, I try to do a panel.
Kentucky's poet laureate Lee Pennington. Yeah, so we have great poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, we got a lot of stuff, but Holly and I were giving out some of your contacts because you have a gorgeous website. Great.
Yeah.
And it's a great way for people to see your covers, especially. They're displayed so well on the page there in your different series. It's easy to browse. But that's, of course, abigailkeem.com. But I hear you have a TikTok channel, and so I definitely want to hear all the social media you're emphasizing nowadays.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, TikTok. I just put one up today. It's a learning curve to do TikTok. It's a learning curve, and what do people want to see? I'm pretty proficient at Instagram. I'm pretty well do that well. But TikTok, that's a different animal. That's a different animal. And so I'm struggling with it, but we'll see how it goes in the next 6 months.
People love, I'll tell you the secret, if people love to see people being real on there, like their real lives inside their homes, stuff that they enjoy doing or talk about, or like if you sit and say, well, I got this idea for this book, you know, from this location, like if you actually go somewhere, you'll be like, yeah, I wrote it about, you know, this location and stuff. They eat that up because they like to see real. Some TikTokers show real life.
I just posted one today of me setting the table, my dining room table, for a fancy dinner party. So stuff
nice.
Like that.
Yeah, I don't have any videos, but I do have an account, and I am following you now. I did follow, yes. So I'll be definitely checking it out. But do you emphasize any other social media that you'd like to direct listeners to? Are there any other platforms you want to emphasize?
Well, my author's page, Facebook, Abigail Keem, and that's spelled K-E-A-M. People always think it's King, K-I-N-G, but it's not. It's K-E-A-M. My author page, I put a lot of stuff on that. I find that's the best way to reach my readers is Facebook, but I am certainly going to give this TikTok a chance.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Get them younger readers.
Yeah, Holly loves TikTok, so I know she'll be following you regularly there, and I'll definitely check in. But
Holly
loves TikTok.
I think they're fun. I do this the quirky regular videos, but yeah, I'd like to start doing some. I want Steve to like do some where he reads or he talks about, you know, talks about inspirations for your books and stuff. If y'all sit and do that, you know, or just show
especially
some things
now,
that you're interested in around your house. People like to get to know their author.
I have a full beard now, so I can, you know, look like a wizard with his cat, you know, or something like that. Now I have a full beard.
There you go.
I should say cats, because we have two. We have two lurking here, which Abigail is well aware of. Yeah, they both like Abigail.
Yeah, I'm allergic to cats, so of course they're climbing all over me.
Yeah. Well, there you go. New book 19, Death by Cats.
There you go.
And then you got an easy way to put cats on the cover, and then you can sell a million. Thank you, Stephen.
You
that's right. Just gave you your million seller now. And you can model them after Albert and Vicky, if you'd like. Oh, but on that note, that's got me cracking up a little bit. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been a blast visiting with you, and I'll let you say anything you'd like to close out, Abigail, and then Holly, you can bring us out.
Well, listeners, it's the Josiah Reynolds Mysteries and the Mona Moon Mysteries. Look them up on Amazon or any Kobo, Google, iBooks, Barnes & Noble, they're on there. And it's Abigail Keem, K-E-A-M. And I'll wing it to you, Holly.
Thank you, Miss Abigail, for coming on and being a great guest and slash host. We had some Stephen Zimmer insights there. I love that. That's fun.
Plot twist.
But, yes, please, that was great. Please check out Miss Abigail's books. wherever great books are sold. And we will have another great guest for you next Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you all have a wonderful end to your week. Catch you later.